Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Real estate, the climate disaster scores that could make or break your home sale. Millions of home sellers and buyers are caught in the battle over how to rate a home's exposure to natural disasters. By Jean Eaglesham and Nicole Friedman. John Simeone was sure his vacation condo, nestled in New Hampshire's White Mountains, would sell easily. Then the listing went live in August. It was like a bolt of lightning hit me in the head. The three-bedroom townhouse in Lincoln, New Hampshire, was labeled on the home listing site Zillow as an extreme 9 out of 10 flood risk. Simeone was shocked. The home is around 60 feet above the nearest river, and the flood rating shown on Zillow linked to a report with a different address. He thinks the rating spooked buyers. Despite a price cut, his $769,000 home remains unsold. Millions of home sellers and buyers are caught in the battle over how to rate a home's exposure to natural disasters and who gets to see that information. Until November, all the major listing platforms showcase scores from First Street, a small but influential climate research company. It rates homes by their vulnerability to wildfire, flood, wind, heat, and poor air quality. A backlash from the real estate industry prompted Zillow in November to remove the scores from display while still allowing buyers to click through to the data. Other listing sites still show the scores, but some will suppress them if a seller objects. The flood score for Simeone's home no longer appears on Redfin or Realtor.com at his request. A very high flood or fire score makes a house less likely to sell, according to a Zillow analysis last year. It can also create a disaster discount, with high-scored homes that do sell more likely to go for under the initial list price, the analysis found. Home buyers are especially attuned to how climate change is unleashing disasters with unexpected frequency, location, and intensity. With the housing market shifting in their favor, they can avoid homes with high-risk scores or use the warnings to negotiate lower prices. Some sellers said that their First Street scores can be inaccurate and difficult to change. First Street's report for Simeone's property in August showed a 97% chance of an inch of floodwater reaching the house within 15 years, part of its 9 out of 10 rating. After the Wall Street Journal asked about the error in the address, First Street corrected the report, changing the score to 7 out of 10. The 15-year flood projection dropped to a 52% chance. Simeone said a rating of 7 is an improvement but still ridiculous. First Street said the address error was the fault of one of its data providers. The home's flood rating reflects the risk from rainfall and not, as Simeone assumed, the river, the company said. The scores fill a gap left by federal and state government flood and wildfire maps, which can be outdated or exclude certain risks. Many of the homes flooded by Hurricane Helene in 2024 or burned by the 2025 Eaton Fire in the Los Angeles area weren't deemed high risk on official maps. Private climate scoring companies such as First Street promised to do better. Their models are designed to reflect how climate change is increasing the frequency and ferocity of natural disasters. The very existence of this industry is an indictment of the failure of the public sector to get a grip on the problem, said Oliver Wing, chief scientific officer at Fathom, a flood risk modeling company owned by the reinsurer Swiss Re. First Street, set up around a decade ago, dominates the supply of climate data for listings. The home listing platforms pay to use its ratings and link through to its website. Its models combine detailed topographical and natural disaster data with climate change projections, forecasting risks 30 years into the future. This matches the duration of a standard home loan. Models created by First Street and other providers are widely used by the insurance industry to help decide what properties to insure and what to price. The seemingly pinpoint precision of First Street's forecasts to within a 1 percentage point chance of a disaster striking an individual property can be misleading, according to some academics and insurers. Accurately estimating future flood risk at every property in a single city or watershed, let alone the entire United States, is fundamentally not possible given current knowledge, said James Doss Gollan, an assistant professor of engineering and a climate risk specialist at Rice University in Houston. Models can be a good indicator of the risk of a given area, such as a neighborhood. But the unfortunate reality is the more you zoom in, the more that accuracy decreases, Wing of the flood modeler Fathom said. The California Regional Multiple Listing Service, a database owned by the local realtor associations, pushed the listings platform last year to stop displaying First Street's flood risk data out of concern over accuracy. Zillow removed First Street scores from its listing pages. Realtor.com, which is operated by the journal's parent company, Newcor, kept the scores but stopped showing percentage predictions for flood risk. Redfin has left the ratings up but will remove the scores at a home seller's request. If the home insurers are using these models to set rates today and project rates into the future, I think it makes sense that home buyers should be able to access that same information, said Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin. Homeowners said their complaints to First Street are stonewalled, with a boilerplate response but no follow-up or resolution. First Street reviews all homeowner complaints and works to resolve any error, but it is rare for a fix to be required, according to Matthew Eby, founder and chief executive officer. An accurate house-level national flood map is not only possible, it has been done not just by First Street, but many other firms, he said. We stand by our data. One aspect of the scores that has baffled sellers and buyers is that different modelers can reach very different conclusions about the same property. The flood risk to Simeone's home is extremely low, according to the tech company Guidewire Software's Hazard Hub tool, in contrast to First Street's severe assessment. San Francisco-based Climate Check scored the risk at 56 out of 100 as of November. All of these models use valid but different assumptions, and the output results are going to vary, said Cal Inman, co-founder and CEO of Climate Check. The scores depend on estimates of the future impact of climate change, such as the maximum rainfall in a precise location, which can be markedly different. Representatives of First Street and Guidewire declined to comment on rivals' ratings, but defended their own company's analysis. Andrew and Ari Ukowitz sued First Street and Zillow in New York State Court, alleging that a false and misleading high-risk flood rating caused them to lose money on the sale of their Chappaqua home. The three-bedroom colonial, bought for $1.1 million in 2022, sold for $999,000 last year. Opposing the lawsuit, First Street and Zillow said the Yerkwitzes are trying to make the climate scores a scapegoat for real estate loss. The score is forecast and not a statement of verifiable fact, so can't be the basis for an injurious falsehood claim, Zillow said in a legal filing. The legal battle is ongoing, according to court filings. Nancy and Gary Berrios said they can't afford an attorney to fight First Street's severe flood risk score for their Supply North Carolina cottage. My husband's a roofer and I work for a healthcare company, Nancy Berrios said. We don't have $25,000 to give to an attorney. She said the home is inland, has never flooded, and lies outside federal flood zones. Not selling means they have delayed a move to Florida to be near their grandchildren. First Street, in a statement, said the flood risk to the home comes from extreme rainfall that isn't gauged in official maps. Torrential rain was the culprit in the catastrophic floods that last year deluged Washington State and devastated a girls' camp in Texas. Berrios said the flood risk score has scared off buyers. She and her husband have taken the home off the market. Everyone who comes to see the house loves it, she said. But as soon as they see that flood score, they run. Business. Trump's real politic takes over Davos. U.S. foreign and domestic policy and the largest American delegation in years are expected to dominate the long-stayed gathering of global elites. By Suzanne Varenka and Chip Cutter. Davos, Switzerland. President Trump video conferenced into the World Economic Forum a year ago, demanding lower interest rates from the global elites gathered and threatening tariffs against those making products anywhere but America. This year, he is heading in person to the Alpine Summit with an entourage of U.S. officials against a backdrop of a world in flux, in large part because of his own unconventional actions at home and abroad. Suddenly, an event once dismissed as a talking shop for executives who think they can solve the world's problems has become a must-attend gathering that people are eager to attend. Trump is expected to address the confab in person for the first time in 6 years. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff also helped make up what is likely to be the biggest U.S. delegation in years. World Economic Forum Chief Executive Borj Brend said, "This year's gathering is taking place against the most complex geopolitical backdrop since 1945," Brend said on a media call before the event. The official agenda features topics such as innovation, economic growth, and building prosperity within planetary boundaries, a phrase referring to discussions about how to achieve growth while still protecting the climate. But conversations are expected to be dominated by the Trump administration's moves, from its calls to take control of Greenland to tariffs and the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. There has always been a big elephant in the room that people had to dance around at Davos, and now the U.S. is the big elephant in the room," said David Kenny, an independent director and former CEO of Nielsen, who is attending his 24th Davos summit this year. Continuing conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza are also top of mind for world leaders. Trump plans to use the forum to address at least one of his domestic priorities. He said in a post on Truth Social that he intends to discuss new housing and affordability proposals in his Davos speech. He recently said he plans to ban large institutional investors from buying more single-family homes. The U.S. delegation is expected to take over a late 19th century church turned convening space perched in the center of a frosty mountainside promenade. USA House, whose walls bear insignias celebrating America's 250th anniversary, is expected to be a hub of activity for meetings and other events. Initially, USA House planned to feature administration officials on Wednesday and Thursday, according to a person familiar with the matter, but now, with so many U.S. officials likely to be on the ground, the programming has stretched to a week of sessions with the U.S. delegation. Scammers have attempted to sell VIP passes to the venue. Organizers this weekend posted a warning on the USA House website, noting the volume of inbound queries this year suggests that these fake VIP passes may be the fastest-selling fiction about Davos since Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. Trump's planned trip to the World Economic Forum has rippled through the week's festivities, from the programming to the security arrangements and ID badges. Thomas Crampton, a longtime Davos attendee, said he has been offered hotel badges for 1,200 Swiss francs, equivalent to about $1,500, up from the actual cost of 165 francs. With hotels and apartments scarce, some attendees are preparing to put mattresses in the back rooms of shops or in hotel gyms, he said. The off-the-charts interest in Davos this year, he said, reflects the state of confusion in the world. At times of uncertainty, people look for ways to find out information, and they seek connection and to understand things, said Crampton, who is founder and CEO of Narrative Alpha, a firm that helps venture capitalists and entrepreneurs raise capital. There is just a great hunger to know which way the world is going. Jonas Prising, CEO of staffing company Manpower Group, who has attended Davos for roughly 17 years, said he expected to trade and the state of global alliances to be among the top issues discussed throughout the week. Despite the question that has been debated in the past, irrelevance and global elites and all of that, given everything that's happening, I think there's a great interest in the meeting, he said. The big question is, how can we navigate this, both as nations, as regions, as organizations? In the past, the WEF's annual meeting has played a major role in launching and shaping global initiatives, including some that the U.S. has distanced itself from under Trump's leadership. Among them is Gavi, an international alliance that helps children in poorer countries receive vaccines. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said last year that the U.S. would stop funding the program. The secluded Alpine village of Davos has hosted the World Economic Forum since 1971, attracting world leaders, billionaires, and celebrities to what has become an extravagant schmooze fest. Because of a lack of meeting spaces in town, companies take over stores, restaurants, and even doctor's offices near the main promenade to build makeshift offices. A Hilton Garden Inn is an unusual power center, prized for its location. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Apple CEO Tim Cook have been spotted there in prior years. Sidewalks ice over, toilets are tough to come by, and numerous security checkpoints mean attendees seem to be constantly, yet carefully, rushing or waiting in lines. Among the 3,000 expected participants this year are 850 CEOs and chairs of the world's top companies, organizers said. More than 60 heads of state and government, including German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, will join business leaders including Microsoft's Satya Nadella, JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon, and NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang. Trump is resetting the world agenda and Davos has to follow him, said Mark Penn, a former Clinton advisor turned ad executive. At this week's gathering, discussions of climate change and diversity, equity and inclusion, two longtime Davos topics, are likely to be more muted than in past years, longtime attendees say. Trump's administration has focused on the rollback of DEI initiatives and the elimination of so-called woke ideology. It is taking steps to dismantle DEI programs across the federal government and corporate America. Trump slammed DEI initiatives during the speech he delivered virtually last year to Davos attendees, calling such policies discriminatory and touting his work to abolish them. These were policies that were absolute nonsense throughout the government and the private sector, Trump said. The official theme of the 56th WEF gathering is a spirit of dialogue, with an agenda that highlights increased polarization and how growing competition among major powers is altering global influence. While more than a dozen sessions on the program address climate issues this year, parts of the agenda acknowledge the polarization of the subject. Last year, there were about 27 sessions under a discussion track dubbed Safeguarding the Planet. This is the conference's first year under new leadership at the World Economic Forum. Geneva-based WEF has been grappling with governance issues and a shift in leadership with the exit of founder Klaus Schwab in April. Schwab resigned as executive chair last year after the board opened a probe into a whistleblower's allegations of misconduct by him and his wife, including unauthorized spending and inappropriate treatment of female staffers. Schwab has denied any wrongdoing. The board discovered minor expense irregularities, but no material wrongdoing. The conference organizer shuffled the leadership of its board in the wake of the probe, naming BlackRock CEO Larry Fink and Andre Hoffman, the vice chairman of Swiss pharmaceutical company Roche Holding, as interim co-chairs. The race to develop cutting-edge artificial intelligence tools is expected to be another major theme of this year's discussion. The implications for work and workers and skills is, I think, going to be front and center, said Maria Flynn, CEO of the nonprofit Jobs for the Future. And after a year of dwelling on tariffs, supply chains, and trade volatility, many CEOs say they are eager to return to growth mode. Christoph Schwetzer, CEO of Boston Consulting Group, said a client told him they can't squeeze the lemon a whole lot more in cutting costs and instead want to hunt for deals and new investments to increase revenue, efforts likely to be pursued at Davos. 2026 is a growth imperative, Schwetzer said. Policy. Pentagon places 1,500 soldiers on alert for possible Minnesota deployment, officials say. Move comes as Trump has threatened to invoke Insurrection Act in response to widespread protests. By Laura Seligman and Maggie Severns. About 1,500 active duty soldiers have been placed on alert for potential deployment to Minnesota in response to widespread protests over immigration enforcement in the state, according to four defense officials. The Pentagon has ordered the soldiers from the U.S. Army's 11th Airborne Division to prepare to deploy, meaning they are ready to quickly move to Minnesota if the order is given, three of the officials said. The move is precautionary, in case the unit is needed, one of the defense officials said. The Department of War is always prepared to execute the orders of the Commander-in-Chief if called upon, said Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell, in response to an inquiry about the potential deployment. A White House official said, "It's typical for the Department of War to be prepared for any decision the president may or may not make." In response to the Minnesota protests, President Trump has threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act, a 19th century law allowing the president to deploy the military in a civilian law enforcement role inside the country to suppress rebellion against the U.S. government. Trump has threatened during both his first and second terms to use the Insurrection Act when protests broke out in different cities, but has yet to do so. Historically, lawmakers and presidents have viewed invoking the act as a measure of last resort, used only when other law enforcement efforts are unable to keep the peace. The unrest in Minnesota intensified earlier this month when a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer fatally shot 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good during an operation in Minneapolis. Good's death sparked protest in Minneapolis. Mayor Jacob Frey said on CNN on Sunday that his city has many mechanisms to achieve safety aside from the Insurrection Act. The Pentagon placing soldiers on standby was clearly designed to intimidate the people of Minneapolis. And here's the thing, we're not going to be intimidated, Frey said. Governor Tim Walz has also mobilized the Minnesota National Guard, a state agency said in a social media post on Saturday. The post said the troops hadn't yet been deployed to city streets, but indicated the Guard would be used to help local law enforcement, including supporting peaceful protests. Trade. China reports robust economic growth thanks to resilient exports. Momentum slowed recently, with investment falling and consumption moderating. By Hannah Miao. A surge in exports powered China's growth last year, defying expectations that a trade war with the U.S. would hobble the world's second-biggest economy. China's gross domestic product expanded 5% last year, when adjusted for deflation, according to data released Monday by the country's National Bureau of Statistics. That met Beijing's official growth target and is in line with the 5% real GDP growth notched in 2024. At the beginning of last year, many analysts expected new U.S. tariffs to stifle China's exports and depress growth. Instead, China boosted its exports to markets around the world, more than making up for a drop in trade with the U.S. Turned out the trade war didn't really hit China heavily, said Larry Hu, chief China economist at Australian investment bank Macquarie Group. Last year, China's customs agency reported a record $1.19 trillion trade surplus for 2025, driven by a 5.5% increase in exports. Economic momentum in China weakened as the year went on. For the fourth quarter, China said its economy grew 4.5% from the same period a year prior, slowing from 4.8% for the third quarter. Some economists say China's economy is exhibiting two-speed or K-shaped growth. Exports and manufacturing are strong, while consumption and the property market remain weak. We have an uneven recovery, said Zhang Grongyu, Citi's chief China economist. Fixed asset investment, a measure of investment that tracks spending on assets such as homes, factories, and roads, fell 3.8% in 2025. That marks the first annual decline in the data series dating back to at least 1992. Though methodological changes make drawing historical comparisons difficult, the only other period of falling fixed asset investment occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic. The deceleration in fixed asset investment growth was the most concerning, said Helen Kuo, chief Greater China economist at Bank of America. Local governments have been focused on paying off debt, which has curbed infrastructure spending, according to economists. Meanwhile, investors in the manufacturing sector are being more selective amid an anti-involution campaign in China aimed at reining in excessive competition driven by overproduction and muted domestic demand. China's real estate malaise stretched into another year, with property investment falling 17% in 2025 from 2024. Some economists believe that the sharp drop in fixed asset investment in the latter part of 2025 may be in part due to previously overstated data. Economists at Goldman Sachs said other alternative metrics, such as cement production, didn't register the same dramatic slowdown, but rather have declined steadily in the past few years. Gross capital formation, a measure of investment used to calculate GDP, contributed 15% to China's economic growth in 2025, the lowest share since 1997, according to the National Bureau of Statistics. Exports made up 33%, the highest share since 1997, and consumption contributed 52%, up from about 45% the year prior. Retail sales, a key gauge of consumption, rose 0.9% in December from a year prior, down from 1.3% in November, marking the slowest growth since 2022. Chinese leaders have pledged to set up initiatives to bolster domestic demand and raise the contribution of consumption to economic growth. China in the coming year is expanding a consumer goods subsidy program, which helped pull forward big-ticket purchases of items such as washing machines and electric vehicles earlier in 2025, but has since lost momentum. Though Chinese consumers aren't expected to step up their consumption significantly, some analysts predict China could increase spending on infrastructure, helping shore up investment. Erica Tay, an economist at Malaysian bank Maybank, said a sustained increase in household spending will depend on improving incomes, job prospects, and the property market. That will be key to a more enduring consumption recovery, she said. China's total population shrank last year, standing at 1.405 billion at the end of 2025. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Down from $1.408 billion recorded in 2024, according to the Statistics Bureau, new births in the country fell to 7.92 million, down from 9.54 million in 2024. Markets and finance. Precious metals climb as Trump lands tariffs on European countries over Greenland. Gold surged to a fresh record intraday high while silver jumped. By Ronnie Harui. Precious metals climb Monday after President Trump threatened 10% tariffs on imports from 8 European countries starting February. Trump's latest tariff announcements has escalated trade tensions into an entirely new dimension, one driven less by economic logic and more by political motive, two members of ING's Economic and Financial Analysis Division said in a research note. It is also pushing the long-standing transatlantic relationship into a severe crisis, with a clear risk of further escalation and unwarranted negative consequences for both Europe and the U.S. economy, ING added. Gold surged to a fresh record intraday high, while silver jumped as the geopolitical risks, spurred by Trump's threat, seemingly triggered demand for safe haven assets, including precious metals. Spot gold rose 1.4% to $4,658.82, a troy ounce, after earlier touching $4,690.88 an ounce. Spot silver climbed 3.2% to $92.99 an ounce. The U.S. will impose a 10% levy on goods that Denmark, which has sovereignty over Greenland, exports to the U.S. beginning February 1, Trump said Saturday in a social media post. The U.S. will also place a 10% tariff on imports from Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, and Finland, he wrote. The tariffs would rise to 25% on June 1 and remain in place until a deal is reached for what he called the complete and total purchase of Greenland, Trump said. Other safe haven assets, such as the Swiss franc and the Japanese yen, also strengthened. The dollar fell 0.3% to 0.7997 against the franc and edged 0.1% lower to 157.84 yen. Geopolitical risks continue to build, said Matt Simpson, senior market analyst at StoneX, said in a commentary. Whether this is a serious policy threat or just another throwaway comment remains to be seen, he said. But given the U.S. kicked off the year with a hostile takeover of Venezuela, nothing can be ruled out for now, Simpson added. Stock markets in Asia were mixed. Japan's Nikkei stock average fell 1.0% and Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index declined 0.7%. China's Shanghai Composite Index rose 0.5% and South Korea's KOSPI added 0.9%. Meanwhile, U.S. stock futures fell, with E-mini NASDAQ 100 futures sliding 1.1% and E-mini S&P 500 futures down 0.8%. Stocks. The Magnificent Seven drove markets. Now they're pulling in different directions. The AI trade that bound the group's stocks is coming apart, and most now trail the overall market. By Hannah Aaron Lang. The Magnificent Seven is now the Mag Five, or is it the Fab Four? Investors are no longer grouping the market's big tech stocks together in quite the same way. The fortunes of what was once Wall Street's favorite band of mega cap names have diverged in the past year, as professional and ordinary investors alike take a more cautious view of the artificial intelligence spending boom. Only Alphabet and Nvidia outperform the S&P 500 in 2025. And so far this year, Five Mag 7 stocks are faring worse than the broader benchmarks. Money managers say the moniker, which also includes Microsoft, Meta Platforms, Apple, Amazon.com, and Tesla, are no longer synonymous with stock market stardom. The correlation has fallen apart, said David Bahnsen, chief investment officer of Bahnsen Group. What they have in common is being trillion-dollar companies. It is a sign that the AI trade has evolved since the raging bull market began, with traders now placing their bets more selectively than before. Some expect the benefits of artificial intelligence will spread to industries like healthcare. Others are doubling down on the chip makers or the energy companies they expect to power the build-out. You're starting to see it broaden out, said Michael Harnett, the Bank of America strategist who is credited with coining the Magnificent Seven moniker back in 2023. The name comes from the classic Western movie featuring seven heroic gunfighters and their push to save a small town. The next Magnificent Seven will be the mega-cap companies who can show that AI adoption is transforming their huge businesses, he said. Don't forget in the film, only if you survive. Individual investors, many of whom were loyal Mag 7 shareholders, have also started turning their attention to other parts of the market. These retail investors accounted for a significantly smaller proportion of overall trading volume in those seven stocks last year than they did in 2023 or 2024, according to Vanda Research. Tesla, a longtime favorite of ordinary investors, has seen the biggest decline in retail activity. Average daily retail turnover dropped 43% in 2025 from the peak in investor interest 2 years before. Harnett said he initially grouped the stocks together based on their standard characteristics as huge, well-run companies that were dominant in the tech sector. But the AI arms race has been driving a wedge between members of the Magnificent Seven for some time. Amazon, Alphabet, Microsoft, and Meta are now the hyperscalers, spending hundreds of billions to train new AI models, build data centers, or expand cloud computing capacity. NVIDIA still dominates the markets for the chips needed to power the most advanced AI models. Meanwhile, the others are lagging behind. Apple shares trailed the S&P 500 index last year, when the iPhone maker faced criticism for spending less and losing ground to competitors on AI efforts. Tesla stock, once a market high flyer, has vastly underperformed several of its Magnificent Seven peers as sales of its electric vehicles have slowed. They're all at different stages, said Michael Aron, chief investment strategist at State Street Investment Management. The rising tide has lifted all boats, and now we're going to get the winners and losers. While they might have headed in different directions, each of the Mag 7 still has an outsized influence on the market. Together, they comprise roughly 36% of the S&P 500's market capitalization, according to Dow Jones market data. Wall Street has left behind a winding trail of nicknames and acronyms that have long since gone out of style. There was the Nifty 50, the group of industry-spanning stocks that gained popularity in the late 1960s. There was BRIC, which lumped together the emerging markets of Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and Watch for retailers Walmart, Amazon, Target, Costco, and Home Depot. That is not to mention BAT, China's Baidu, Alibaba Group, and Tencent. Fang, a Mag 7 predecessor made up of Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google parent Alphabet. Fang, same group but with Apple, and Granolas, a group of 11 big European companies, including GSK, Roche, and Novo Nordisk. The Magnificent Seven may have lost the reason investors had linked them in the first place, but for now, no other posse of stocks has come to take their place. There is not a suitable replacement yet, Aron said, but I think there probably will be. Even MBAs, From top business schools are struggling to get hired. Business school grads face months-long searches and consider pay cuts. Top schools open doors, but they don't walk you through. By Lindsay Ellis. Just how difficult is it to hold in today's professional job market? It's taking many of America's most credentialed business school graduates months to land and accept offers. With companies scrutinizing every white-collar hire, the job market for MBAs has sputtered for more than a year. That's weakening a reliable catapult into executive trap jobs that can pay hundreds of thousands of dollars. Though there were hiring rebounds at some of the most elite programs, including Harvard and Columbia universities, hiring from many top-tier business schools remained below pre-pandemic levels. At Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, for instance, 21% of job seekers were still looking for work 3 months after graduation last summer. About 15% of those at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business remained on the hunt. Those rates are similar to 2024, but sharply lower than 2019, when many employers couldn't hire enough white-collar professionals. Just 5% of job-seeking MBAs graduating from Duke then were still looking for work 3 months post-graduation. At Michigan that year, it was 4%. John Bush, 33, earned his MBA in May from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He initially sought finance jobs in New York, but widened his net to banks in Charlotte, North Carolina. He is now also considering luxury retail after spending time in Paris. One role he applied for in retail had an annual salary of $80,000, less than what he earned before going to business school. It might be worth it, Bush said. The U.S. added an average of about 49,000 jobs a month in 2025, the lowest pace of growth in more than two decades, outside the most recent recessions. Most were in health services, not what business school graduates widely pursue. And graduates faced steep competition as layoffs drew hundreds of thousands of workers into the job market. Students were having a rough time, said Terry Parker De Leon, Fuqua's executive director for its Career Management Center. The school connected graduates with one another and with coaches to strategize on searching. Companies often set MBA hiring targets months before graduation season and make offers long before graduates will join the payroll. That advanced planning was especially challenging this past year, employers and campus career officials said, as companies contended with an on and off again global trade war and the implications of artificial intelligence. At Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, a quarter of MBAs were still looking for work 3 months after graduation, up from about 16% the year before and 8% in 2019. Two factors especially didn't help, said Christine Murray, managing director of the Career Center. More than half of the school's 2025 MBA graduates were international students, many of whom face visa uncertainty. And the Washington, D.C. labor market was flooded following federal cuts. The last 2 years have just been really terrible, she said. This fall, the school is rolling out a new curriculum emphasizing career readiness, shaped with input from employers. Some business schools say dialing up networking efforts and training students in artificial intelligence improved their hiring outcomes this past year. At Columbia Business School, 10% of graduates were still looking for jobs 3 months after graduation, down from recent years. A surge in hiring from Boston Consulting Group, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Amazon contributed to the increase, school data show. So did more than 200 companies hiring from the school for the first time. Harvard Business School said it is deploying AI to help match its MBAs with openings from multiple job search sites and with alumni who work at those companies. That, plus leaning on alumni and faculty to coach students in their searches, helped MBAs get hired, said Zedzel Neely, chair of the MBA program. Fewer HBS graduates were looking for work 3 months after graduation compared with prior year, 16% versus 23%, though at a higher rate than before COVID-19. It's a changing world, and we need to mobilize to support students, Neely said. By late November, all but 10% had accepted jobs, and half of those graduates had received offers, the school said. HBS graduate Daniel Alves Do Quetel said he networked extensively and asked professors to connect him with former students or colleagues working at the consulting firms he was targeting. Top schools open doors, but they don't walk you through them, the 29-year-old from Portugal said. He joined BCG in New York after graduation, pitching himself as a no-brainer hire who had won promotions before and wanted to stay in consulting long-term. I'm not just selling only potential, I'm selling on performance. Alexis Rooney, who graduated from HBS last spring, said she leaned on a 6-person virtual job search team with fellow grads that HBS organized. One helpful tip she picked up from someone in the group: write a case study or other work sample to get another look, even after a rejection. The rejection is just a no. You could turn it into a yes, Rooney said. She is pursuing product marketing and marketing strategy jobs, and while she has gotten interviews, they haven't turned into offers. It has been hard to compete against job candidates who were recently laid off from that exact position, she said. Heather Byrne, managing director of the Career Development Office at Michigan's Ross School, said some students are finding more opportunity at smaller or mid-sized companies. Once bigger companies understand how AI will impact their organizational charts, she expects their hiring uncertainty to ease, but that could take years, she said. The people who are patient and who continue to network are appropriately flexible and adaptable with their expectations and will be the ones who do well, Byrne said. Jobs. Economists are studying the slowing job market and feeling it themselves. Newly minted PhDs tend to work for universities, government agencies, and big white-collar companies. It's not a great hiring time for any of them. By Justin Lahart. Economists will tell you that it is a tough time for people entering the job market. They can relate. It is the worst market young economists have faced in memory. The economics job market is getting buffeted by a confluence of forces. Worries about federal funding have led many major universities to reduce or even freeze hiring. Jobs within the federal government have dried up. The private sector, where demand for economists has been intense in recent years, has pulled back. It's like a perfect storm, said Syracuse economist John Cawley, who heads the American Economic Association's Job Market Committee. The tough market for doctoral students finishing up their studies is hardly unique to economics. What's different about economists is that they are intensely interested in measuring and understanding how labor markets work, and they have brought that to bear on their own profession. As a result, armed with data from the AEA and all the knowledge they gained in graduate school, doctoral students in economics have a much more precise grasp of what type of environment they are facing than their counterparts in political science, philosophy, or biophysics. The AEA functions as the main clearinghouse for economics jobs through its Job Openings for Economists Network, or JOE. Institutions both in the U.S. and abroad post openings there. Openings are way down. By the AEA's count, as of December, there were 1,773 job openings for PhD economists. That wasn't just below the level of a year earlier when demand for economists was already weak. It was also down by about 20% from the same point in 2020, the year the pandemic buckled the market. The data included in a series of charts on the AEA's website for graduate students to stare at, or not stare at, as the case may be. Some people are like, I'm not going to look at the graphs. The graphs don't exist for me until May, said Danielle Graves Williamson, a Boston University doctoral student who is on the market. For others, including her, the data is comforting. Graves Williamson said, because it lets them know that if they don't land the kind of job they hope for, they are hardly alone. The weakness is broad-based. Job openings for full-time academic positions are down by 33% from a year earlier, according to the AEA. There are only 24 federal government job listings, down from 84 a year earlier. The number of job openings in a business and finance has been soft for a third year running. Typically, the job market has no problem absorbing the roughly 1,300 PhDs that U.S. economics programs mint each year. The value of an economics PhD has risen over the past quarter century. The analytical skills the field teaches have made it a popular major for undergraduates, business schools have grown, and other academic areas, such as schools of health policy, have taken on economists. In graduate programs, students learn to employ sophisticated techniques to comb through massive data sets and develop models of people's behavior. That provides expertise that has been in increasingly high demand in Silicon Valley and other companies looking to profit from the flood of consumer data they are collecting. The pay can be very good, too. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Economics Department, one of the top programs in the world, lists starting pay for a junior tenure-track professor at $225,000 to $254,000. But the reality for economists on the job market now is much different than what they might have imagined when they applied to graduate school 5 or 6 years ago. I thought COVID was bad, but this is much worse than COVID, said Donna Ginther, a University of Kansas economist who earned her doctorate in 1995. It is the worst job market I've ever seen. The economics job market has its own peculiar rhythms and hierarchies. In the fall, students who are finishing their PhDs, as well as economists in postdoctoral programs, apply for jobs that typically start the following summer. But because students can apply to dozens or even hundreds of jobs, this creates a matching problem. How does a prospective employer know which candidates are serious? Economists being economists have tried to solve this. When a candidate applies for jobs via JOE, they are able to send up to 2 signals of interest for jobs they are particularly interested in, almost like a winking emoji in a dating app. That signaling system was put together with the help of Stanford economist Alvin Roth, who also developed systems for matching kidney donors with patients and New York City school children with schools. Roth won an economics Nobel Prize in 2012 for his research on how to improve the way that people can be matched with limited resources. Even the top programs are feeling the effects of the tough market. MIT economist David Oter, who is the economics department placement officer, said students have had about a third fewer interviews than a year ago. He said many employers that don't normally attract PhDs from MIT have sensed a buyer's market and have reached out to him, and that many students are applying. The optimistic scenario is that MIT's candidates will end up gainfully employed in great jobs, albeit not the jobs they would have potentially gotten in a normal year, he said. That would have a cascading effect, though, with MIT students taking the types of jobs that in a more typical year might go to students at somewhat less prestigious schools, and students from those schools displacing others. Students from top programs typically aim for jobs at large universities where they would be able to focus much more of their time on research rather than teaching undergraduates. 4-year colleges tend not to be high on their list, but this year is different. Hamilton College economist Stephen Wu noted that there have been an unusually large number of applications for the tenure track opening in his department, and that the quality of the applicants is extremely high. I'm getting emails from friends and colleagues at other schools saying, hey, there's this candidate we would expect to be getting interviews from the top places, and they're not, he said. I'm seeing a lot of that. Correction and amplifications. John Colley is a Syracuse University economist. An earlier version of this article incorrectly said he was with Cornell University, his former affiliation. Commodities and futures. Bullish gold market drivers still very much in place. There is more reason to believe gold will consolidate or edge higher than sell off sharply, said George Chivalny, a natural resource portfolio manager at 91. Gold's rally has been powerful, but it has also been grounded in fundamentals that are still very much in place, he says. That includes a weaker U.S. dollar, ongoing geopolitical tensions, and expectations of Fed rate cuts, as well as heightened concern over fiscal deficits and sustained central bank demand. In Sydney, gold miners Northern Star is up 3.5% at $27.77 a share, while Evolution Mining is 2.4% higher at $13.44. Precious metals climb after Trump threatens Europe with tariffs over Greenland. Precious metals climb in the early morning Asian session on likely safe haven demand. President Trump said Saturday that he would impose 10% tariffs on imports from some European countries to pressure Denmark to sell Greenland to the U.S. Trump's latest tariff announcement has escalated trade tensions into entirely new dimension, one driven less by economic logic and more by political motive. Two members of ING's Economic and Financial Analysis Division say in a note, it is also pushing the long-standing transatlantic relationship into a severe crisis with a clear risk for further escalation and unwarranted negative consequences for both Europe and the U.S. economy, they add. Spot gold rises 1.7% to $4,674.46 an ounce. Spot silver climbs 3.8% to $93.49 per ounce. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.